Good afternoon. It's Thursday, September 23rd, 2021, and time to read from today's Sioux City Journal. I'm Sandy Barron. I'm a volunteer and pleased to be able to bring you the news today. Here's a look at what we'll be reading. First, we'll read stories of local interest. Next, we'll turn to the opinion page, and at half past the hour, we'll read the obituaries. We'll conclude with sports and feature stories as time allows. First, let's take a look at the weather. Today, mostly sunny, breezy, and pleasant, winds out of the south 8 to 16 miles per hour with a high of 78. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 50. Tomorrow, sunshine mixing with clouds with a high of 71 and a low of 41. Saturday, sunny and pleasant with a high of 75 and a low of 53. Sunday will be mostly sunny and very warm with a high of 84 and a low of 53. And Monday will have plenty of sunshine with a high of 82 and a low of 52. The sun rose this morning at 7:14 a.m. and will set tonight at 7:21 p.m. Tomorrow, Friday, the sun will rise at 7:15 a.m. and set at 7:19 p.m. Next, here's the mini editorial. This comes to us from the Journal Editorial Board. Welcome to fall, the last hurrah before the misery of winter. And again, this is from the Journal Editorial Board. And our front page story is headlined Securing Mapleton's Future. It's accompanied by a large picture showing Matthew and Samantha Kelm, who bought the historic building at 322 Main Street in Mapleton 2 years ago. With the help of grant money, they plan to renovate the top floor into apartments and the ground floor for business space. This comes to us from Nick Heitrick of the Sioux City Journal from Mapleton. Chances are future tenants in the soon-to-be-renovated downtown Mapleton building won't need to take up arms and be on the lookout for bandits. It's not the 1920s, when a rash of Monona County bank robberies led to the formation of a vigilante group that used the second floor of the building at 322 Main Street. Taking advantage of a unique architectural feature that juts out from the corner of the building and gives whomever's inside a commanding view of downtown Mapleton, the vigilantes would sit with rifles and Colt revolvers at the ready, keeping watch over the town's three banks. Whether word got around about the vigilantes or Mapleton's bankers just got lucky, no one ever attempted to rob one of the town's banks, and the vigilante group disbanded sometime around 1930. It's a fun story from Mapleton's past, but the new owners of the historic building at the corner of 4th and Main Streets are focused on the future. We're hoping the building is there and in good shape for a long time, said Matthew Kelm, who bought the building with his wife Samantha nearly 2 years ago. Thanks to a $100,000 state community catalyst building remediation grant that the city will administer, the two natives of nearby Ute, who now live in Mapleton, plan to renovate the second floor, which has been vacant for some 40 years, into apartments and gut and fix up the ground floor to lease for business use. They hope to begin renovations later this year on the building, which, according to local historian Keith Robinson, was opened in 1893 as a dry goods store and was commonly known as Friedman and Goldberg's. Since then, it's housed an appliance store, cafe, grocery store, and most recently, a consignment store. The Kelms, Samantha in particular, looked at the attractive exterior and envisioned some much-needed housing and new business space. It was my wife's idea. She likes the way it looks, Kelm said. We have had a few different people ask about it. A similar transformation is going on at another historic building on the corner across the street. Built in 1893, the two-story building at 321 Main Street was at various times a law office, hardware store, restaurant, and five and dime store, among other things, but had been vacant for 10 years before the city acquired it in 2013. The city received a total of $88,000 in state grants to remove the asbestos, stabilize the building, and replace the roof. In 2019, it received a $100,000 catalyst grant to renovate the building into an upstairs apartment and a ground floor business space. Tally the grants the city and the Kelms have received, and it adds up to more than $250,000 being spent to rehabilitate the two buildings at the city's main intersection. Critics may ask if it's worth that much to fix up a couple of old buildings. Mayor Brent Streck said it's a better use of the space than demolishing them and putting in a parking lot, one of the ideas floated for the city-owned building. The two buildings being worked on are really cornerstones of the business district, Streck said. This is maintaining their character and making it valid for the next 40 to 50 years. The worst thing you could do is knock it down and put up a steel building. As renovations continue on the city-owned building, the city hopes to sell it to someone who will open a new business on the ground floor, putting the property back on the tax rolls and continuing a trend of building restorations completed elsewhere in town. There's a lot of growth in the community right now, Streck said. City Clerk Carla Yule said she'd hate to see an empty lot or two at the city's main intersection, plus shared walls and other surprises often make tearing down century-old buildings a challenge. Grant programs make it easier and more affordable to renovate them. It's almost easier now to get money to restore buildings than to tear them down, Yule said. Without grants, it really would have been a financial stress for the city. It would be sad to see the two buildings that have witnessed so much history go away, Yule said. They're just kind of a mainstay in town. Thanks to all that grant money, they will continue to be so for years to come. And another picture accompanying this story shows Matthew Kelm cleaning upstairs in the aerial of his historic building overlooking downtown Mapleton. The frequently asked question of the day is, why do you have someone call to see if what we've written a letter to the editor? And the journal staff responds, to verify if indeed you did write it. Pranksters have been known to pose as someone other than themselves just to make someone look bad. Calling is just another form of checks and balances. And if you have a question for FAQ, send it to bmiller@siouxcityjournal.com or mail it to Bruce Miller, Sioux City Journal, 515 Pavonia Street, Sioux City, Iowa, 51101. Today's online poll question is, what is your favorite season? Yesterday's poll question was, do you watch Dancing with the Stars? And of the 51 people voting, 10% said yes and 90% said no. Today's speak out question is, what historical building would you like to see saved? And you can sound off at facebook.com/Sioux City Journal. Iowa leader of virus response leaving agency. This comes to us from Des Moines. Iowa's medical director, who was a visible advisor to Governor Kim Reynolds in the early months of the coronavirus pandemic, will quit her job next month, the state's Department of Public Health announced Wednesday. Dr. Caitlin Padatti, who also serves as the state epidemiologist, appeared in numerous press conferences Reynolds regularly held last year as COVID-19 cases spread throughout Iowa. Padatti has taken a much less public role more recently as the state has experienced a surge in cases involving the Delta variant that has sickened more children and young adults. Officials didn't say why Padatti was leaving and only stated she, quote, plans to pursue new career opportunities. Throughout the pandemic, Padati largely followed Reynolds' policies, even when they conflicted with medical science at the time. She was silent when Reynolds reopened businesses in May 2020 as the state continued to see high case counts and deaths. The governor took the posture that Iowans must learn to live with COVID virus activity without letting it govern their lives, although infectious disease experts said it was too soon and would lead to more illness and death. Padati also stood by as Reynolds refused to implement a mask mandate to slow virus spread, as recommended by medical professionals, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and a White House virus task force. In early October, a federal task force in former President Donald Trump's administration told Reynolds that many preventable deaths were occurring in Iowa after she lifted business restrictions and refused to require that masks be worn in schools or other public places. Average daily deaths increased to 10 per day, with 250 deaths in the month prior to the report. Reynolds eventually implemented a limited mask requirement in mid-November after a record 1,510 people infected with COVID-19 were hospitalized statewide. When she lifted it in February, she did not consult the public health department. In August 2020, Padati acknowledged she was aware of inaccuracies in the state's coronavirus data when her agency used it to release flawed calculations that helped guide decisions on school openings and enrollment. Padati said she became aware of the previous month of a problem in Iowa's disease surveillance reporting system that backdated thousands of new test results. Prior to her role in Iowa, Padati worked as a medical epidemiologist for the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services. Reynolds said Padati was instrumental to our state's strong COVID-19 response and a valued member of my team. The health department release said the agency will work quickly to fill the position. Sioux City schools to require masks on buses. This comes to us from the Journal staff from Sioux City. The Sioux City Community School District will begin requiring masks on school buses Thursday. We understand this change could cause frustration for some, and we ask for your patience as we work to make certain we follow all laws in place at the state and federal levels, according to a letter to parents. Since the temporary ban on the legislation signed by Governor Kim Reynolds banning mask mandates on school property, the Iowa Department of Education reiterated their position that federal guidance requires masks to be worn on public transportation, according to the letter. All students and drivers will be expected to wear a mask while traveling on our school buses, even though there is no mask mandate in place for our school buildings or school events, according to a news release. The mandate also applies to extracurricular travel on school buses. Last week, the school board decided against a district-wide mask mandate after hearing feedback from parents, teachers, and the community. And we have a few briefs here. The first one is entitled, Man Charged in Infant's Death Gets Prison, from Primgar. A Sheldon man was sentenced Wednesday to 5 years in prison for causing injuries that led to the death of his infant daughter. Lawrence Ruotolo, Jr., 20, pleaded guilty in August in O'Brien County District Court to one count of child endangerment, a Class D felony. A second count of child endangerment was dismissed as part of a plea agreement. Ruotolo was caring for the child on July 26, 2020, at the home he shared with the girl's mother, Brittany Baker, when the child began crying and Ruotolo was unable to quiet her. He lost his temper and pushed the girl's face into the floor and committed other abusive actions, court documents said. The child sustained a large abrasion and bruising on her forehead, inside and outside both ears, and on her neck, and redness on her right eye. Baker took the child to the emergency room, and the child was treated and released. The following day, the child was again in Ruotolo's care when she was found with no pulse and was not breathing. She was taken to the emergency room and then airlifted to a Sioux Falls hospital, where she died 4 days later. The death was caused by a suffocation event of an indeterminate nature, the court documents said. Baker, 21, of Sheldon, is scheduled to stand trial on 2 counts of child endangerment in December. Stacy Hurlburt, 50, of Sheldon, was charged with 2 counts of accessory after the fact for helping the parents concoct a story about how the child was injured. She is scheduled for trial in November. Marcus' mom put on probation from Cherokee. A Marcus mother who encouraged her 13-year-old daughter to have relationship with an older man has been placed on probation. The 40-year-old woman, who the journal is not naming in order to protect the victim's identity, pleaded guilty September 14th in Cherokee County District Court to child endangerment and aggravated misdemeanor. District Associate Judge Andrew Smith suspended a 2-year prison sentence and placed the woman on 2 years probation, and she was also fined $855. According to court documents, the girl's mother encouraged her and her brother to befriend Rashawn Daly, 22, of Lamar's, in the summer of 2017. Shortly after the girl turned 13, Daly moved into their Marcus home, where he supplied marijuana to the residents. The girl told authorities she had been in a sexual relationship with Daly from the summer of 2017 until October of 2020. The girl said she had told her mother she did not want to be with Daly, but her mother would encourage her to give him another chance and to stay with him, court documents said. Daly was arrested in April and is scheduled to stand trial in November on 2 counts of third-degree sexual abuse. Pedestrian struck by car in Royal, from Royal, Iowa. A woman walking on a Royal Street was injured Tuesday after being struck by a car. The Clay County Sheriff's Office was dispatched at 7:45 a.m. to the 100 block of Main Street, where deputies determined that 73-year-old Linda Youngbluth was walking east on the street when she was hit by an eastbound car driven by a 17-year-old girl. Youngbluth was transported to Spencer Hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. The juvenile's name was not released. The car she was driving is owned by Michelle Haraldson. World Championship Ice Racing coming to Tyson, from Sioux City. World Championship Ice Racing will slide into Sioux City's Tyson Event Center on February 26th. Beginning at 7:30 p.m., racers will shred the arena's solid ice track with over 2,000 razor-sharp studs in their tires, going from 0 to 60 miles per hour in less than 3 seconds. Tickets for the event go on sale at 10 a.m. Monday. Tickets are available online at TysonEventCenter.com by calling 712-279-4850 or by visiting the Prime Bank box office at the Tyson Event Center. Tickets start at $22 for adults. Youth tickets, 4 to 12 years of age, are only $9. Early access to the pre-race pit party is available for $5. We turn now to the opinion page, and we have an editorial on that page from Other Voices, and this editorial comes to us from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Are voice-activated assistants spying on us? Apple's Siri, Amazon's Alexa, and Google Assistant systems that listen to human voice commands and carry out tasks are being accused of abusing that technology by listening in when they're not supposed to in order to gather marketing data. The companies generally deny it, but because they control this complex technology, the lawsuits now underway may be the only way to know whether it's happening in some form. A federal judge in California last month made the right call in letting the litigation against Apple go forward. Even in an era of amazing technological developments, a voice-activated assistant stands out. Siri, Google, Alexa, and other systems allow the user to simply say a wake-up word or phrase, Alexa, for example, or Hey Siri, followed by specific voice commands. Depending on the system, it can play music, turn on lights or furnaces, or answer virtually any question imaginable with the whole internet available to it. The technology is undeniably useful. To function, the systems need the ability to listen in on the human voices around them. That technology, plaintiffs in multiple recent lawsuits allege, is being abused by companies that offer the systems. They claim the systems have listened in when they weren't supposed to, possibly because they detected a sound similar to a wake word. Further, they claim the unexpected eavesdropping resulted in data gathering that was used to market products to the unsuspecting humans whose voices were eavesdropped. One user of Siri claims in litigation that the system overheard him talking with his doctor about a certain surgical treatment and that he later started getting targeted advertisements for that treatment. Others claim private discussions of a range of other topics, sneakers, sunglasses, specific restaurants, triggered targeted ads for related products. The allegations aren't so far-fetched. Anyone who has spent much time browsing the internet knows the eerie feeling of being tracked and inundated with junk mail and calls offering deals on cars, shoes, or bedding shortly after clicking on websites that sell cars, shoes, or bedding. The companies that operate the voice-activated systems acknowledge that some snippets of conversations are recorded for human review for purposes of improving responses. It's not a far leap to wonder if these conversations are also being used for something else. If so, that's a cynical misuse of technology and a fundamental violation of privacy. People allow these systems into their homes to serve them, not to mine their private conversations for sale opportunities, and certainly not to have that private information sold to third-party contractors, which is among the allegations. Any business that would spy on its own customers wouldn't hesitate to lie to them about it. Therein lies the benefit of asking these questions not on the company's customer service lines, but in court. And you can share your opinion. We welcome reader feedback. Letters to the editor may be no longer than 250 words and will be edited for length. Please include your name, hometown, and daytime telephone number for verification. We will not publish anonymous letters or open letters to a third party. We will publish no more than 2 letters and 2 mini editorials per writer a month. Letters, mini editorials, and guest opinions may be published or distributed in print, electronic, or other forms. We turn now to the sports page. East Volleyball crushes CB Jefferson. This comes to us from the Journal staff from Sioux City. The Sioux City East Volleyball team beat Council Bluffs Jefferson on Tuesday night in dominant fashion as the Black Raiders swept the Yellow Jackets by set scores of 25-12, 25-10, and 25-11. With the match win, East improved to 15-4 on the season, while Jefferson fell to 2-20. The Black Raiders will play again on Saturday at their home tournament. Siouxland Christian 3, Woodbury Central 1. The Siouxland Christian volleyball team secured a 3-1 win on Tuesday over Woodbury Central as the Eagles won sets 1, 3, and 4 by a score of 25-8, 25 to 23, and 25 to 13, while dropping two sets to the Wildcats, 28 to 26. Eagles senior Peyton Donhofer led the way on offense with 25 kills, while sophomore Alex Heilbluth had 32 assists. Both players, along with teammates Reagan Stocking and Gwen Gates, had two aces in the match as well. With the win, Siouxland Christian improved to 4-9, while Woodbury Central fell to 2-11. Galen Catholic 3, West Sioux 0. The Galen Catholic High School Volleyball took down West Sioux in straight sets on Tuesday night as the Jays beat the Falcons by set scores of 25-16, 25-12, and 25-20. Senior Larissa Sitzman had a team-high 8 kills for Galen, with senior Lauren Hying and junior Maya Whitehead closing close behind with 7 apiece. Whitehead also led the team with 9 digs in the game, while junior Candace Goble had 23 assists and a team-best 4 aces. With the win, Galen Catholic's record improved to 11-5, while West Sioux fell to 5-11. The Jays will play again on Saturday in the Hartley-Melvin Sanborn tournament, while West Sioux will host Alcester Hudson on Thursday. Sergeant Bluff Luton 3, Council Bluff Lincoln 0. The Sergeant Bluff Luton High School volleyball walloped Council Bluffs Lincoln on Tuesday with a sweep victory, with the Warriors beating the Lynx by set scores of 25-8, 25-16, and 25-16. Sergeant Bluff Luton improved to 13-3 overall and will play again on Thursday at Western Christian. From Sioux City, East Northwest Triangular. Sioux City East golfer Ethan Spear came out with a victory on Wednesday afternoon at the Sioux City East Triangular at the Whispering Creek Golf Course, as Spear edged out teammate Cole Johnson with a 9-hole score of 37. Johnson placed second with a 38, while fellow Black Raiders Jack Reese and Jack Sanderson finished tied for third with a score of 41. As a team, East ended the match with an overall score of 242, while Sioux City North combined for a score of 281. North's top finisher was Blake Moss, who shot a 42 to tie East's Drake Anderson for third place. Sioux City West finished third with a team score of 297. The Wolverines' top finisher was Christian Lane, who shot a 53. In men's soccer, Briarcliff 3, Dakota Wesleyan 0. The Briarcliff men's soccer team beat Dakota Wesleyan on Wednesday in a 3-0 shutout. The Chargers scored all 3 of their goals in the first half. 3 minutes and 37 seconds into the game, Luis Paulo Sartor scored his first goal of the game. At 41:40, Alpha Fay scored an unassisted goal of his own, and Sartor followed that goal up just over a minute later with his second goal of the game. Chargers goalie Leandro Faria made 3 saves in the game, while Dakota Wesleyan goalie Hunter Barozzi managed 12 saves on 15 Briarcliff shots on goal. With the win, Briarcliff improved 5-5, while Dakota Wesleyan fell to 1-8. And Morningside 4, Northwestern 1. The Morningside University women's soccer team beat Northwestern College on Wednesday afternoon by a 4-1 score. All 5 goals came in the second half of the game. At 49:30, Northwestern scored an own goal and added to their lead with a goal from Victoria Stausel. Natalie Larson made a 3-0 game with a goal at the 59:44 mark. Northwestern finally got on the board with a score from Katie Jacob to make it a 3-1 game, but Morningside's Ebba Torgner scored an unassisted goal at 68:03 mark to put the score at a final 4-1. Morningside improved 4-2, while Northwestern fell 3-6. It's half past the hour, and we turn now to the obituaries. The first one comes to us from Danbury. Gary Enier Sentjens, that's S-E-U-N-T-J-E-N-S, 76, died Friday, September 17th. Services will be September 24th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Danbury. Burial will be after the service, Danbury Catholic Cemetery with military rites. Visitation will be September 23rd from 4 to 7 p.m. at the church. Arrangements with Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Mapleton. From Rock Valley, Gilbert C. Hugendorn. Gilbert C. Hugendorn, 87, died Monday, September 20th. Services will be September 23rd at 2 p.m. at Porter Funeral Home in Rock Valley. Burial will be after the service in Valley View Cemetery, Rock Valley. Visitation was held September 23rd at the funeral home. Colleen Ankersian, and that last name is spelled A-N-K-E-R-S-T-J-E-R-N-E. Colleen Ankersian, 82, died Sunday, September 19th. Services will be September 28th at 11 a.m., First Congregational Church, Peterson. Burial will be private in Oakland Cemetery in Peterson. Visitation will be September 27th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Warner Funeral Home in Peterson. From Ida Grove, Brenda D. Ulrich. Brenda D. Ulrich, age 60, died Friday, September 17th. Services will be September 25th at 10:30 a.m. at Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home in Oldebolt. Burial will be after the service in St. Martin's Catholic Cemetery in Oldebolt. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. From Sioux City, Matthew James Jensen. Matthew James Jensen, age 27, died Sunday, September 19th. Services will be September 26th at 6 p.m., Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City, 4125 Orleans Avenue. Visitation will be September 26th from 4 p.m. until service time at the funeral home. From Sioux City, Virgil Beach. Virgil Beach, 58, died Saturday, September 18th. Celebration of life will be September 30th at 4:30 p.m., Sertoma Park, Sioux City. Private family burial will be October 1st at 11 a.m. at Dakota City Cemetery in Dakota City. Arrangements are with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. From Sergeant Bluff, Susan Christine Sanderson. Susan Christine Sanderson, 68, of Sergeant Bluff, died Tuesday, September 21st, at a local hospital. Services will be held at noon on Friday at Christy Smith Morningside Chapel with burial following in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday with the family present from 5 to 7 p.m. and a prayer service at 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Susan was born in Sioux City on September 18, 1953, the daughter of Martha Viola Donhauer. She attended Sergeant Bluff Community Schools, graduating with the class of 1971. She was united in marriage with Randy Sanderson, June 17, 1995, in Hinton. Susan worked at several different employers in Siouxland area and eventually retired after several years at Petch Optical in 2007. Please make memorials payable to the family for designation at a later date. From Sioux City, Sarah S. Sanders. Sarah S. Sanders, 35, passed away unexpectedly at her Sioux City home on Saturday, September 18th. Services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday at Glad Tidings Lighthouse Church, located at 410 East 10th Street, South Sioux City. Pastor Michael Ring will officiate. Nelson Berger Northside Chapel is assisting family with arrangements. Online condolences may be directed to www.meyerbroschapels.com. Sarah was born on March 20, 1986, to her parents Tanya Kasky and Dan Hank Sanders. Sarah was a loving, kind, and very strong woman who met every challenge in life head-on with a will that said never give up. She attended Simple Life, where she enjoyed many activities, volunteering, and socializing with the friends she made there. From Dakota Dunes, Linda Johnson. Linda Johnson, 83, of Dakota Dunes, passed away peacefully on Monday, September 20th, at a local hospital. Services will be held 1 p.m. on Saturday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, 3220 Stone Park Boulevard in Sioux City. Visitation with the family present will be 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, with a prayer service and Eastern Star service at 7 p.m. at the funeral home. The family will hold private graveside services at Logan Park Cemetery in Sioux City. Online condolences may be given at www.meyerbroschapels.com. A caring wife, mother, and grandmother, Linda was brought into this world on September 11, 1938, in Sterling, Illinois, to Hugh and Bernice Hardacre. Linda lived her younger years in Cedar Rapids. After graduating from high school, she went on to pursue a nursing degree at Iowa Methodist School of Nursing in Des Moines. While attending nursing school, Linda met and fell in love with Edward, Ed. The two married on September 10, 1960, and shared a loving life together for over 61 years. Though she enjoyed nursing, Linda paused her career to dedicate spending time with her children during their school years. She later resumed her career and worked until 1992, when she retired. Linda was a member and past matron of the Rose Croix chapter of the Order of the Eastern Star. She also traveled regularly with Ed to attend Ed's many Grand Lodge and Grand Commandery events, and was awarded the Knights Companion of the Temple by the Grand Commandery Knights Templar of Iowa. From Jefferson, South Dakota, Terry L. Koertner, that's K-O-E-R-T-N-E-R. Terry L. Koertner, 54, died Tuesday, September 21st. Services will be September 24th at 1 p.m. at Sunnybrook Community Church. Arrangements are with Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. From Sioux City, Oscar E. Ortiz, 50, died Thursday, September 16th. Arrangements are with Waterbury Funeral Service. Next, we turn to an article which is about coronavirus questions and answers, lessons to learn. What are current COVID-19 guidelines for schools, lessons to learn? It's back to school season like no other for students, teachers, and parents across the U.S. Across the U.S., schools have opened nationwide this fall, only to find thousands of students and their teachers sickened by the coronavirus. That wasn't the long-awaited return to normality many had hoped for in resuming in-person instruction. Along with the surge in cases, districts have contended with angry parents, school board members, and the public on the questions of mandated vaccines. Quarantine rules have changed, so have mask requirements. Confusion and distress abound. So what is going on in U.S. schools? The details differ from district to district, but here are some answers. What does the CDC recommend about masks in schools? The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend everyone wear a mask in schools, regardless of vaccination status or local case levels. What about lunch? How are students supposed to play the saxophone? Schools should have distancing plans for when people need to remove their masks indoors, the CDC says, such as while eating or during band practice. I had close contact with someone who had COVID-19. Do I have to stay away from school? If you're unvaccinated, the CDC wants you to get tested immediately and quarantine for up to 14 days. In some places, you can return to school sooner if you test negative. If you've recovered from COVID-19 in the last 3 months and have no symptoms, you don't have to quarantine. Same if you're fully vaccinated, but monitor for symptoms. If I test positive, but am fully vaccinated and not showing symptoms, can I go to school? No, the CDC says that anyone with a positive test needs to isolate for at least 10 days, even if they're not showing symptoms. Students and staff should only return to school at least 10 days after developing symptoms or receiving a positive test, and at least 24 hours since any fever has subsided without the use of medication and other symptoms have improved. What about football practice, the school play? Federal officials emphasize that people in quarantine or who are ill shouldn't participate in sports practices or other extracurriculars. Okay, but what counts as close contact? How far apart do students have to be? The CDC says generally that being within 6 feet of an infected person for a total of 15 minutes or more over a 24-hour period counts as close contact. But over the summer, this agency made a special exception for K-12 students in classrooms. Encountering infected students within a 3 to 6 feet doesn't count as long as everyone was masked up correctly. Teachers and other adults are not granted the same exemption. What difference do mask policies make for quarantines? A big one, potentially. Schools that mandate masks are now less likely to have to quarantine, while whole classrooms or large numbers of students when one person becomes ill, although some still are. What do federal officials say about remote learning plans? Some districts have made few or no provisions to teach exposed or sick students remotely, but federal officials do advise them to provide remote learning options, even if that means sending home paper packets. Federal officials say they want districts to focus on maximizing in-person learning, but also make sure students have access to remote technology and good online instruction when that isn't possible. Are districts interpreting these recommendations differently? Is this all just a suggestion? State and individual school districts aren't bound by CDC guidelines. Some states have standard policies they have imposed on all school districts, while others are allowing districts to make their own policies on everything from mask requirements to quarantine rules to remote learning policies. Can schools require COVID-19 vaccines for kids who are old enough? Again, it depends on where you live. At least 9 states have explicitly said schools can't require vaccination, including Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Indiana, Iowa, Montana, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas. A number of states and individual districts are requiring teachers to get vaccinated, in some cases allowing them to opt out with regular testing for the virus. Earlier this month, the Los Angeles Public School System became the first big district to require all of its eligible students to get vaccinated. Some other big districts are requiring students in sports and extracurriculars to get inoculated. What's going on with bus driver shortages? How do kids get to school? Districts nationwide are suddenly short on bus drivers on account of the tight labor market and fear of coronavirus infections. In Massachusetts, the state has even called out the National Guard to keep the buses running. And in a related COVID-19 stories, impulse spending, 5 ways to rein in the urge to shell out for non-essential items. Since the COVID-19 vaccine became available in the U.S., there have been more opportunities to impulse spend on items and experiences you didn't get to enjoy early in the pandemic. And with more freedom, consumers are spending more. For the first 7 months in 2021, retail sales were up 15.5% compared to that same period in 2020, according to calculations by the National Retail Federation. As some restrictions have eased, it's likely you've had new spending needs, returning to work, visiting with friends and family, and partaking in other back-to-normal activities. But when the non-essentials threaten to put your finances in jeopardy, it's important to keep your financial goals on track. Here are five strategies to help you navigate impulse spending. 1. Wait a day or two. When you feel that overwhelming urge to spend, wait 24 to 48 hours to see if you still want an item, suggests Brad Klontz, a financial psychologist based in Colorado. Ask yourself, can I afford this? Where am I going to put it? How am I going to feel about this purchase tomorrow? How am I going to pay for this, he says. He adds that the pause can help calm the emotional brain and activate the rational brain, the one that holds you accountable tomorrow. If you can't bring yourself to wait, a store's return policy may prove useful should regret set in. The return protection benefit on a credit card, if available, can also offer a backup option. 2, practice safe credit card habits. Credit cards may help or hurt depending on how you spend. Klontz says that people spend significantly more money when using credit cards instead of cash. He suggests keeping a cash envelope to use in areas where you tend to overspend, like dining out, for example. Also, minimize impulses by not storing credit card information on websites or apps, says Kathy Longo, a certified financial planner and president of Flourish Wealth Management, a financial planning firm in Minneapolis. It's so much easier to be like, I'll look at it later because I'm not going to find my purse and get my credit card, she says. That time can indirectly make you rethink a purchase. Once you do charge a purchase to a credit card, pay it off in full to avoid interest and save money. For large purchases, consider using a card with a 0% introductory APR. 3, use curbside pickup to curb temptation. Many retailers have offered curbside pickup since the start of the pandemic. It's one option that Lauren Miller of Massachusetts uses to stay on track in her debt-free journey. Avoiding the inside of the store means you're not seeing those seasonal items and those flashy marketing strategies, she says. These can often lead to impulse buying. If a retailer charges for curbside pickup or requires you to spend a certain amount of time, a certain amount to waive the cost, weigh whether it's worth paying a few dollars to avoid the potential cost of impulse spending. If you have to go into a store and the urge wins, do an online price comparison of the item, suggests Longo. See if you can find something similar at a better price or maybe on sale, she says. 4, give yourself a splurging allowance. Build a personal allowance into your budget for potential splurge purchases. When Miller first started to curb her impulse spending, she gave herself $20 to use at each store and lowered it to $5 per store over time. The desire to make impulse purchases lessens, I think, because I know I have permission to make an impulse purchase if I choose to do so, she says. If you exceed your allowance, take that amount out of next month's budget or supplement it by redeeming credit card rewards for each bank or statement credit if it makes sense. But if impulse spending is constantly causing you to stray from your budget and to get into debt, it may be time to reevaluate spending habits or speak to a credit counselor or financial therapist. And 5, get an accountability partner. An accountability partner can help you dissect your reasoning for a purchase. They don't have to offer an opinion, just an ear. The goal is to hear yourself talk about the purchase out loud and make a decision that aligns with your goals and values, Plantz says. He suggests choosing a spending limit that merits discussion. For instance, if a purchase exceeds $100, then it may be worth running it by an accountability partner. Another option is to use social media followers to stay accountable. Miller, as a content creator on YouTube, documents her progress on social media platforms by sharing her plans to stick to a shopping list. On the sports page, putting it all together, this comes to us from Zach James of the Sioux City Journal, from Brunsville, Iowa. MOC Floyd Valley High School senior Emerly Haverdink doesn't want to run alone next month at the state cross-country meet in Fort Dodge. Haverdink has had several experiences running at Lakeside Municipal Golf Course in Fort Dodge, but she hasn't had the chance to run with her Dutch teammates at the state meet. Haverdink, this week's Journal Siouxland Athlete of the Week, wants to change that for her senior season while accomplishing the goal of running at the state meet herself. It gives a lot of confidence that I have strength, that I have confidence, and I have the training, and it's all there, Haverdink said. I get into the right headspace and pray with my teammates before each race, and that always helps me. Dutch coach Doug DeZoo believes that the lineup is strong enough for the Dutch girls to make it to state cross-country meet on October 20th. MOC Floyd Valley is ranked 5th in Tuesday's IATC Class 3A girls poll. We just have to make sure we put it all together, DeZoo said. The Dutch senior has finished in the top four every meet this year, including a win at the August 31st meet at the Spirit Lake Invitational. There she ran the race in 18 minutes, 46 seconds. Over the last 10 days, the Dutch have competed in two meets, and Haverdink got top five in both of those meets. Haverdink placed fourth at the Ridgeview-hosted Tim Thomas Classic with a time of 20:29. Then at the Storm Lake Invitational last Tuesday night, the Dutch senior placed second behind Lindsay Sonderman of Harlan. Haverdink ran the race in 1942, while Sonderman won in 1936. Haverdink is ranked 7th in the IATC Class 3A individual girls poll, and she is ranked just one of the two Class 3A seniors ranked in the top seven. When she's not winning second or third, she's always finishing behind someone who is ranked up there pretty high, MOC Floyd Valley coach Doug DeZoo said. That doesn't bother her. She enjoys competition. She's a mentally strong runner. DeZoo said that the main thing that Haverdink has worked on during the season is her pace. She started the season strong, and the Tim Thomas meet is the only meet where she hasn't turned in a time of 20 minutes or less. Haverdink's journey began by looking up to former Dutch runner Emma Haley. The two runners connected right away. Haverdink noticed how much Haley loved cross country, and Haley was able to show Haverdink the benefits to loving the sport. Haley's passion must have seeped into Haverdink's heart, because now Haverdink has passed on that passion to the younger Dutch runners. I think they see how hard she works and the miles she puts in, DeZoo said. She's just a positive influence. She never has a bad thing to say. You don't see the negative side. She goes out and does her thing. She doesn't need accolades or anything like that. An honorable mention for this award this week, Emily Dreckman of MMCRU, the senior Royals hitter, is 6th in Class 1A with 180 kills. And from West Lyon, Jackson Meyer. Meyer scored the go-ahead touchdown on Friday night to beat Central Lyon George Little Rock. And that brings us to the end of reading the Sioux City Journal for today, Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. If you have any questions or comments for Iris, please call 1-877-404-4747. Thanks for listening to your Sioux City Journal. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.